this is Sarah from The Journey, and welcome to another Ask the Expert special. Now, you may have noticed we're pretty into hormonal health, as it is pretty much the basis for everything in our bodies. So today's special guest is Dr. Antoinette Falco. Now, she is a naturopathic doctor, she's a fertility awareness expert, but more specifically, she is an expert in hormones, fertility, and also pregnancy. So we thought she would be a fantastic person to have on our show. Now, she's going to be talking to us about a huge range of subjects around this. She's also going to talk about her own experience with an undiagnosed thyroid issue, plus autoimmunity. And then she's going to be talking to us with a few surprising things about the contraceptive pill, what you really need to know, and then how to transition your body off it once you want to start thinking about your fertility. So without me ruining everything in the podcast, let's dig right in. Hi, Antoinette. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be here.
So why don't we kick off by you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into doing what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. My background, I practice as a naturopathic doctor and fertility awareness educator, and I do a little bit of birth dueling as well. And what really started my work into hormone health, that is the area that I've found myself focusing in a lot in my practice online when I work with clients, as well as in my local practice. And so, yeah, it started for me about, I was in my early 20s, and I went to go see my GP, and I was under routine testing. And because I had a family history of thyroid conditions, I had shown that I had elevated TSH, and that meant that I had hypothyroidism. And right away I was put on Synthroid. And to be honest, I was completely blindsided. It took me a while to get the right dose. It was changing. I was still feeling tired. I was experiencing weight gain. My acne was really bad. And I was also learning that the thyroid is such a vital organ and involved in so many processes in the body. So that also led to, I was having irregular periods. They were heavy. They were painful. And I was all in my early 20s trying to understand being in university and the challenges of just adolescence. And then when I finished university and started naturopathic medical school, I learned the importance of getting complete thyroid testing. And this is where I was seeing an intern at our student clinic, and she had recommended, hey, why don't we do a full panel, you know, get your TSH tested, your T3, T4, reverse T3, your thyroid antibodies, so that can understand fully.
So you got the antibodies test as well, because I know not that many people do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I was completely shocked, because I say this to my patients as well. To this day, I have never seen antibodies as high as the ones that I saw the first time I had them tested. Wow. Like, they were off the charts, goodness. And I've seen a lot of thyroid blood work over the years. So that came as a complete shock to me, complete shock, because now I no longer was just dealing with a hypothyroidism diagnosis, but I also had Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune condition of the thyroid. And in Western medicine, the treatment doesn't change in their eyes. You're on Synthroid. That's going to help, quote, manage your symptoms. And the antibody piece doesn't really get talked about or even investigated,
despite the fact it's almost completely different. Can I just ask?
Completely, right?
Did you have, so you said that you were being tested as a routine basis because of your family history. So does that mean you didn't really, other than maybe the heavy irregular periods, did that mean that you didn't really have many symptoms before you went and got tested? Or were you getting, you know, some pretty significant symptoms before that point?
No, it's exactly that. I wasn't having the alarming symptoms that people think of when they think of hypothyroidism. And that's actually, I would say, common, is because a lot of the symptoms of a thyroid condition can be masked by other things, right? If you're, I don't know, if you have a lot of stress in your life, or if you're working yourself, like I was a university student, there was a lot of I was like staying up late, studying a lot of long nights, like being tired all the time. You just kind of assume that that's quote normal. Same with period irregularities, right? Your doctor saying like, oh, that's just like part of being a young teenager. And it wasn't until after I think that I started to realize, no, all those symptoms that I was feeling that I thought were quote normal, they actually could have been the start of me having this autoimmune condition and thyroid condition.
Yeah, it's alarming actually, because what we perceive as normal often is maybe normal to us, but on the grand scheme of things is not normal. And sometimes, you know, it's only when you kind of get these things treated, you realize how abnormal you felt. Now, for those people listening, because I think you made a really, really good point, there is a big difference between getting a regular thyroid test done and getting a full panel. And it seems to me that unless you really are exhibiting some very strong symptoms, a kind of traditional doctor will go and just do the basic test. So can you give us a bit of an insight what the difference is and why you think it's actually important to get a full thyroid panel done?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, where I am here in Canada, a TSH is the first test that is done. The research that actually looks at TSH and its ability to use it as a diagnostic marker for thyroid condition is probably like that. That's where that comes from. But the research is outdated. It needs to be updated because we're really only looking at such a small piece of the thyroid puzzle, if you will. So getting a full panel, regardless, and I always encourage my patients to advocate that with their care providers, because of the way healthcare works in Canada, and it's covered by the government. You don't always get resistance with your medical care team. So where you have doctors, like you have naturopathic doctors, you have functional medicine doctors, they're usually the ones who are advocating to get the full panel done. And the reason a full panel is so important is because you need to know, are you dealing with an autoimmune condition? Are you dealing with a conversion issue? So this is, again, what needs to happen in terms of thyroid pathology is you need to have TSH, which is thyroid stimulating hormone, that triggers the thyroid to take T4 and make it into T3. And T3 is the active thyroid hormone that actually is what goes to all the cells in the body and creates the desired action at a cellular level that it needs to happen. So if you have an issue with a conversion, you're not going to see that by getting a TSH tested. And same with the antibodies. You're not going to know if you have abnormal antibodies just from a TSH. Because what I have seen in my practice is women who have the Hashimoto's comes on first. So they have abnormal antibodies before their TSH is flagging an issue. And
I guess that makes sense because obviously, you know, it's your body attacking the thyroid. So therefore it's likely to not function so well after it's been attacked for a while.
Exactly. And I mean, it's unfortunate because if women knew that from the beginning, they could change things in their life. They could intervene to help with that autoimmune piece so that it didn't progress to, you know, destruction of the thyroid plus an abnormal conversion or hormone piece associated with the thyroid.
So as you say, you know, Hashimoto's is, you know, an autoimmune condition, and more broadly, autoimmune conditions seem to be on the rise globally, even things like type 1 diabetes, I mean, a whole host of things. And of course, then you have celiacs, and it seems to be the case that for whatever reason, this is becoming more and more common. And obviously, as you say, sometimes things like Hashimoto's, you don't actually notice. So why do you think that this is happening more prevalently? And why do you think it happened to you?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah, I would say why it happened to me. There's in my work, after finding out that I had Hashimoto's, it was really about getting to the basics of my health and really understanding my immune system and how it was shifting more towards an autoimmune side of things. So even just growing up, I never got sick very often. And, you know, that should have been an alarm for me, because your immune system needs to get sick, because then it changes what's happening in terms of, like, it's fighting an external pathogen, versus my immune system was just so hyper-focused on attacking myself, being my thyroid. So in my journey, it linked to leaky gut. Like, I learned later that there was foods that I should not have been eating, and they were linked 100% to my Hashimoto's, because one of the things I did is I took out gluten and dairy were the two big ones that I took out immediately after realizing my antibodies were really high. And within 3 months, I saw those antibodies go down by half. And I was I was like, this is amazing. Like, because it was insight that I never knew. And with food sensitivities, you don't always feel symptoms of them. And I would say that was my story. I never had digestive issues. I never had pain or irregularities. Like, there was never anything I struggled with, but the food sensitivities were triggering an autoimmune reaction in me. And that was more of a serious, you know, that was more serious. Like, if I had symptoms, maybe I would have done something about it sooner. So I would say, to answer your question in terms of, like, why these autoimmune conditions are on the rise, I think diet and lifestyle, you know, external pathogens, like, we live in quite a toxic world. Yeah, we're exposed very much so. To, right?
Yeah.
Food is, like, not being grown like how it used to be. We're, like, genetically altering. We're adding chemicals, you know.
Antibiotics everywhere. Pesticide use have gone through the roof. And it's things like plastics, and it's everything, you know. Yes. And again, I guess it's what we're saying before. It's become normal. And, you know, if you look back even 50 years ago, things looked, you know, very, very different. So what was it that prompted you? So I guess it's, you know, part of your education, you know, you was very health centric and health focused. What was it that made you start to look about your gut health? Because obviously that's another, you know, really interesting bit of emerging science around how the gut can be very powerful also for your hormones, but, you know, especially as well from when it comes to immunity. So what was it that made you kind of take a look at that? And what are some of the things that you think you've learned through your kind of own journey around healing your own gut and how that's impacted your symptoms?
Mm-hmm. In medical school, because our approach was more from a holistic perspective, we were talking in detail about the immune system and how essential it is for all aspects of your health. And some of, like, just like you said, emerging research, we don't fully understand a lot of the immune system, but so much information is coming out about how it's linked, how gut health, how immunity is linked to so many other conditions, you know, mental health, hormone health, you name it. So I always say it's 70% of our immune system starts in the gut, right? So everything is linked to optimal gut health. So when you're looking at, you know, a metabolic condition such as a thyroid condition, you know that one of the causes has to be, is there something going on with how you're metabolizing just the food that you're eating, right? Like, our gut is the connection between our outside world. So that, to me, on my journey was, okay, I want to figure out what it was. What is my unique cause to why I have Hashimoto's? And that question came about because I remember being in a class and they were talking about, oh, you know, thyroid condition could be because you're exposed to a lot of chemicals, or you have environmental exposures, or you have, like, gut dysbiosis, and, like, all these things that had never been explained to me. My doctor never explained them to me. I never learned, even in science class when I was in university, I never learned that there could be, like, other reasons linked to this thyroid condition. So it opened my mind up to, like, to so many possibilities, and then going and getting that testing done. And then through the support of an intern at the time, because I was in second year, so I was still learning. It was that firsthand experience that I would say really gave me the evidence. Cause yes, we have research, and research is great, but I also say, like, your body is going to communicate this additional piece of information to you. And that's totally what happened to me. Like, I wouldn't have thought to look into gut health and look into those other causes of Hashimoto's for me unless I got that testing done and I was supported by the right practitioner in order to do that. So my learnings, and I guess my piece of wisdom that I offer to anybody who might be listening and has a similar story, is that working with a practitioner that understands it and is going to support you in what you feel is going on, you know, you can say no. You could say no to your current practitioner and find somebody else who's going to really hear you and who's going to make you feel empowered. Because patients know when something's off, and you really want to get the right testing done so that you can, you know, be on this great journey of understanding how to transform your life and your health.
Absolutely. And I think you made a really good point. You know, your body will communicate this information to you. Sometimes we just have to really, really tune into it and really listen to, because as you say, no one knows your body more than you do. So what are some of the things that you did? Obviously that you mentioned cutting out dairy and gluten, but what are the other things that you did in terms of trying to improve your own gut health?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had to look even at my triggers. So triggers not just being from the food that I was eating, but also stress was playing a big role. And stress and adrenal health also plays into thyroid conditions. And that could be a whole other conversation. But being able to be on top of my self-care practices and making sure that I was building an adequate time for rest in a time that was really stressful, I would say naturopathic medical school was the most stressful time of my life. And so,
how ironic. You
know, I know they really hammered a lot of content into 4 years. So, but yeah, and you know, even to that, even took me about 5 years after that to recover my adrenal health from it. And I had to, adaptogens were a very big part of that recovery process. And adaptogens, for those who might not know, are herbs that help support adrenal health. And the one that I really benefited from was withania. Withania specifically not only helps with the adrenals, but also helps with that conversion of inactive T4 to active T3. So I found like that was a good, that one I really saw improvements from. Probiotics were important, but I also learned that I couldn't introduce a probiotic until I had adequately removed the triggers. So, you know, my patients come in all the time like, oh, I'm taking this probiotic. And I always say, you know, not all probiotics are the same. Let's hold off. Let's start by taking the triggers out and then adding the probiotics in, because you don't want to introduce too much the gut all at once. So yeah, those were big pieces for me. As I preach in my practice, like I'm a food is medicine kind of practitioner. So I, you know, that's something you're eating multiple times a day. If you can really craft your diet to include the nutrients you should be eating and ones that are beneficial for your gut, you know, like fermented foods and, you know, all of those like good gut builders, I think you will go a long way.
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of the research that I've read is that, you know, because the probiotic market is so nascent and it's actually pretty unregulated, it's actually better to really try and go down the food route. And in fact, some of the research I've read says that you can change your own gut microbiome as little as 24 hours by, you know, what you're eating in terms of diversity, fermented foods, prebiotic foods, all that kind of stuff. And it's interesting that you mentioned adaptogens. So I'm personally a big fan of ashwagandha for kind of dealing with stress. So it's very interesting that you mentioned another one that I wasn't familiar with. So you talk as well, obviously, about stress, and it has become like a big part of our modern lives. And again, I think that it's become this new normal, this kind of low level constant anxiety. It's you know, you can't necessarily say we're more stressed than previous generations, you know, generations that went through world wars or whatever, but it's a different kind of stress. And I do think it's our 24/7 culture. It's the fact that, you know, we're always connected,
the blue light, all the kind of disruption. Would you say that you think that that is impacting hormonal health more broadly in the patients that you're seeing? And I'm not just talking about thyroid issues, of course, here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to go back to something you said about ashwagandha. So ashwagandha and Withini are the same herb. They're just different names for it.
I didn't know that. Okay, that's really interesting. Well, I love ashwagandha / Withania.
It's a great one.
I also take that. And that has been a big game changer for my stress levels. So going back to the stress point. So do you think that this has led to more hormonal imbalance in people that you see?
I would say absolutely. And my catchphrase usually with women is, we can throw all the supplements at you. If you're not finding a way to cope and manage with the stress in your life, you're going to constantly hit a wall, and you aren't going to see those benefits from all these supplements that we want you to take. And so the stress coping and the strategies, like that's the hard work. That's the deep root of everything in your health and in your life. And high, depending where you're at, if you're high cortisol or if you're just chronically low and you're kind of on this adrenal fatigue burnout path, that's going to affect your body's ability to make any reproductive hormones. And then that can lead you to, various concerns with an imbalance there. And one of the common examples I always use is the progesterone steal. Right. So if you've got high cortisol, it's going to steal your body's ability to make progesterone. So you can end up with having low progesterone or symptoms of low progesterone if your cortisol is staying chronically high. Right. So stress is involved in everything. And I would say, to answer your question, like, yes, 100%. It is the culprit. But like you also said, it's an area that people have to make a conscious effort on, like, creating that awareness. How is it affecting our life, and how are we going to cope with it and create strategies that are going to be effective?
Yeah. So on that subject, you've obviously had your practice now for a while. And as you're saying, stress is kind of pervasive amongst pretty much a lot of the hormonal issues that you're probably seeing. What are some of the other, key complaints people come to you with? So, for example, I have polycystic ovaries. Similar to you, I did not even realize I had them. I had very, very few symptoms. I didn't even have any family history of it. My only thing was an irregular period that I thought was normal. But, as we also get other stresses, not just mental stress, but physical stresses, mm-hmm. like sugars, for example. I actually have lean PCOS, but I do know that because we have this, horrible Western diet full of lots and lots of kind of refined sugars and processed foods and that kind of thing, it is playing havoc with our insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is also associated with polycystic ovaries. So would you say that, our diets and lifestyle are leading to things like, insulin resistance, which kick on to other disorders? So would you say that's something that you're seeing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And insulin resistance and sugar, that is in itself, yes, creating a physical stress on the body, and it's creating more inflammation, and inflammation, like we chatted about earlier, driving a lot of like hormonal imbalances, such as, estrogen concerns, like having like high estrogen. So it's all related. Absolutely.
Yeah. So speaking of that, with the whole, estrogen dominance that's going on in the world, one of the people on our board, Dr. Mahantesh Karoshi, he talks about the moob or the man boob, which is, he says, becoming much more common. You only have to go down to the beach and you go and see lots of cup sizes that are probably a bit too much for a guy. Estrogen is, very, very pervasive, it seems, in our environment. Do you think that this is more than it was, a few years ago? What do you think are some of the kind of disruptive sources in our kind of day-to-day lifestyles that could be contributing to this?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good question. I would say yes, there are more exposures now. It's those xenoestrogens, and those are chemicals that the body recognizes as it looks like estrogen, so it's going to react as if it's estrogen, but it's really not. So it's creating this hormonal cascade that isn't optimal, and it's leading your body to thinking it's got more estrogen. So high level, some of those xenoestrogens include things like plastics, and plastics are everywhere. You hear about, the BPA on receipts, plastic water bottles, plastic Tupperware, plastics in general are everywhere. Plastic packaging, you buy food, it's in plastic. You buy like even okay, and I'm not just talking about the products that you put, the feminine products you use, but they're also like in plastic. So you just plastics are everywhere, and it's really hard to avoid them. And they contain xenoestrogens. The other category is feminine care products. Women are exposed to thousands of endocrine disrupting chemicals just before they leave their house in the morning. So this is things like shampoos, conditioners, creams, makeup, lotions, anything that you're putting on your body. If you just read the ingredients, they might have things like phthalates and parabens, which is they're well researched as ingredients that are disruptive for your hormones.
Do you know what? I think this is such a great point, because I think because of like amazing marketing that's gone on for like decades from all the kind of personal care and beauty products, we all are led to believe that, they are, and there's all these terms thrown about like natural and organic, but actually as with other areas of industry, they're actually really, really unregulated. And when I say to people, you need to clean out your beauty cabinet, and by the way, kick out anything that's got fragrance in it because it's got phthalates in, people look at me like I'm crazy. But actually, as you say, there is an awful lot of research to back this up. But I think it's these are the things that perhaps people would not day to day think of as being endocrine disruptors. Would you say that's true?
Yes, for sure. And that regulation piece you mentioned is really interesting, because even, top online retailers and such as Sephora, they've recently come out with, their separate marketing logo that says clean at Sephora. And you go to that category and you're wondering, like, are these really clean? And so you really have to proceed with caution as a consumer, and actually look at those labels, read the ingredients. If you can't pronounce something in it, chances are it is a synthetically derived chemical that potentially is harmful for your body. And I will say there is the Environmental Working Group, which is a website that you can go on, and you can put in a lot of these commercially available products, and you can actually see, like, they've given every product a rating, whether or not, I think the rating is out of five, whether or not it's safe and a fully clean product.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite sites, actually. I'm 100% with you on that one. Now, in terms of other day-to-day things that we think are completely normal, you talk a lot about the contraceptive pill and how that can be an impact. And actually, some of the things, some of the reasons that we have estrogen so dominant in our society is because, the hormones from the pill are now in our water supply. So can you talk to
Yes.
us a bit about your approach to what your view is, perhaps why you're saying things that are maybe not quite in the kind of norm, and what your overall view is?
I always start this conversation by saying I'm not anti-birth control, because birth control was created at a time where it gave women choice, it gave them options, they were able to further careers and education. That was huge. For, if you just look at the history of birth control. But what I am against is the anti not having informed consent. And this is where I feel like as a society, we've kind of hit this wall where women are being put on birth control for reasons other than pregnancy prevention. So I think the statistic is 70% of women are put on hormonal birth control for a reason other than contraception. So that means
Wow, 70%.
that's
That's
huge, right?
insane. Yeah.
So it means that you're being given, women are being given the pill as a quote solution to a hormone imbalance. And that is where I have a big problem, because the pill is not fixing. It's not fixing. It's not like, it's not, it's actually doing more harm than good, because it's disrupting your natural hormone rhythms and patterns to the point where whenever you choose to come off it, you, there's a transition period. And there could be this period of 3 months, 6 months, a year, I would say actually closer to a year for some women, where they have to get their periods. Their periods are irregular. They might be, they aren't presenting as they did before they went on birth control. So I say that if you're on hormonal birth control, really think about what's going on, thinking about your future and what you see. If you're planning on having kids in the next year or two, really think about coming off, because that transition may take a while. And some would even say, with the high prevalence of hormonal birth control, this is where we're seeing a high increase in infertility. And this could be, if you think about it, okay, if they're on birth control for, say, 10 plus years, and then they come off, and then maybe they're trying to get pregnant for 6 months, it's not happening. So then they may go and get a referral to a fertility clinic. But it's only been 6 months after they've come off birth control. Like, things are not regular. So this could explain why they're not conceiving. And then that precedes the cascade, right, of the journey down the infertility route. But if we had spent some time looking at our hormones after coming off the pill, then we could have we wouldn't be in that situation.
Yeah, I think that's 100% spot on. It's this notion of having informed consent. And actually, I think that if you ask most people, most people are not really aware, because we're not made aware of what mm-hmm. actually is in the pill and what it actually does to our body. So can you just give people a bit of an idea, for those who really haven't kind of dug into what exactly the pill does and how it works and mm-hmm. how it can therefore have this kind of lingering effect?
Yeah. So I will speak generally about the oral contraceptive. We say the pill. But just as a quick side note, an IUD or anything like that's inserted that does release hormone, there is a possibility that that gets systemically absorbed. So you could still fall into the similar category, because if the synthetic hormone is systemically absorbed, that means it is going through your whole entire circulatory system and having a similar effect. So the pill orally, what it's doing is it's giving you, majority of the pills now are made of progestin. And this is a synthetic hormone that is introduced to the body, and it essentially shuts off the communication between your pituitary and your ovaries. So you aren't getting the hormones that are triggering ovulation, and that specifically being the LH hormone. So it's shutting off that communication. So then when you come off, your body has a really hard job. It has a really big job, because it's trying to then reestablish that communication, and it's trying to produce its progesterone. And so this, if listeners are curious, I do talk about in my post-pill guide that you can download on my website, but progestin is not the same hormone as progesterone. Progesterone the body makes naturally, and progestin is a synthetic hormone, and they actually have completely different effects as well. So that is something that I always like to educate women on, because they think that they're taking something that is, quote, like what the body produces, but it isn't. It isn't what the body's producing. So yeah, that's really important to understand. mm-hmm. And now I lost my train of thought.
No, so you were talking about the difference between progestin and progesterone, and how, you know, most women think that you're taking something that's naturally produced by the body, in actual fact that you're not. And you also said they have different effects on the body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like one, you know, progestin is used to end it, to terminate a pregnancy, and progesterone is the hormone that helps you like thicken your lining for implantation, helps you to maintain a pregnancy. So those effects are so different in the body. And, you know, when we talk about hormonal birth control, we assume that it's like the one thing that actually really irritates me is when women say, oh, I was taking the pill to regulate my cycles. And in fact, that's not what's happening. It may appear that things are status quo, that there's no reaction. But when you think of actually in a physiological level, what's happening is we're just shutting off that communication. We're not actually regulating your hormones.
Yeah, it's doing the classic thing of masking the symptoms, but not actually
a band-aid.
The underlying cause. Now, you mentioned about your postcode guide, and we'll put up links to your stuff up on the site and in the show notes. But can you give us some of the kind of things that if, you know, a patient comes to you and says, right, my period's just not coming back, what are some of the, you know, key things that you advise someone to do in order to kind of re-regulate their cycle?
Mm-hmm. So in my Pill Freedom program, which is helping women transition off hormonal birth control, I break it down into three phases. Phase one being the release phase. And this is like releasing toxins, detoxing the body, cleansing. So this involves your five major detox organs, and that being your liver, your gut, kidney, skin, and lungs. So that phase is really foundational, because we need to make sure that the organs such as the liver, which is essential for metabolizing and producing hormones, is functioning at its best. And then second phase is about reinventing. So I say this as a new way of looking at your hormones. In this phase, I teach fertility awareness method, which allows women to have body literacy so that they can use their menstrual cycles as a diagnostic tool. And this is something that I talk a lot about on my Instagram channel, because you have your menstrual cycle, which is essentially like, it's a vital sign, right? It gives you so much information about what's going on in your health. And as women, we're so lucky to have this extra tool and awareness and body awareness so that we can understand more what's going on with our bodies. And then once you learn a fertility awareness method, then it's a new way of birth control that is hormone free, that doesn't involve any, that is natural and doesn't involve any hormones. And then step three is replenish. And this is where we go into a deep dive on what your body needs to replenish those nutrients that may be deficient from long-term use of hormonal contraceptives. And where I take it a step further is I look at a woman's chart, and I'm able to see some of the nutrients or perhaps like some labs that need to be tested at specific stages to know what might be happening for them. So a common example is a thyroid condition, because the birth control pill causes a lot of shifting in a woman's body. This can also set the thyroid off. So I can see in a chart like where there might be signs of a thyroid condition, and then I'm going to go specifically test for that, and I'm going to make sure that I'm intervening with nutrients that support the thyroid. Just as a general, yep.
It's interesting you say this about, you know, you can look at somebody's cycle and see, and as you rightly say, it is effectively a diagnostic tool. And one of the things that's been in the press recently is a study that was done around giving women progesterone supplements for miscarriage. And one of the things that's, you know, quite well established in science is that if you have a gap of 9 days or less between ovulation and your period, that's known as short luteal phase. Mm-hmm. And that is where you have your body is not producing enough progesterone. So this is exactly, you know, the thing that you're talking about. Now, in that situation, what would you advise a woman to do if, you know, they are, you know, if the cycle is indicating this? Is there any way, or number one, why would your body not be producing enough progesterone? And number two, what is it that somebody can do in order to counterbalance that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if this is a great opportunity for just education on how the menstrual cycle works and where progesterone is produced. So I'll try my best in terms of describing it, but it's definitely better explained with some visuals. But essentially what happens is on the first day of your menstrual cycle, the first day of your period, you've got these small follicles, and inside each follicle is an immature egg. And then what is happening is those follicles are growing in response to a hormone, FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone from the brain, triggering the growth of that follicle. And as the follicle grows, the egg gets more mature. And then that follicle releases estrogen. And then as follicles are growing, estrogen's releasing, estrogen triggers cervical mucus. So you're getting like a mucus phase. And then when one of those follicles is the biggest, it's the most mature, the eggs mature inside, that's called a Graafian follicle. And that's the one that is going to, that you will release the egg from. And that's ovulation. The hormone that is involved there is you have the high level of estrogen triggers LH. And many women who have used ovulation predictor kits are going to know that LH hormone, that's going to trigger. So that spikes. And then after that, ovulation happens. You release the egg. Then what happens with that remainder of the follicle is it becomes a temporary gland called the corpus luteum. And it's the corpus luteum that produces the progesterone that you need for the luteal phase of your cycle, which is from ovulation until the next day, until the start of your next period, sorry. So the health of the corpus luteum is really important for sustaining your levels of progesterone and making enough. So making enough and sustaining the progesterone for your luteal phase. So some key nutrients that the corpus luteum needs, it needs vitamin C, it needs iodine, it needs zinc, and there's many more in that category, but those are some of the big ones. And it's going to make, so it can make adequate progesterone. And then what this corpus luteum, if pregnancy is successful, it's going to be what produces progesterone for the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. So if your corpus luteum isn't producing enough progesterone for 12 weeks, this could lead to miscarriage, because lower progesterone means that you're at risk of miscarriage. So, and then after 12 weeks of pregnancy, the placenta takes over and the placenta becomes your source of hormone production for the remainder of your pregnancy. So to answer some of your questions, like maintaining that progesterone level is important for, an adequate luteal phase. And when I speak about, the normal luteal phase, it's anywhere from 12 to 16 days. I would say on average 13 and 14. If you are 9 day, then you are suffering from a shorter luteal phase. And there are some conditions as well. And I think it all comes back to the nutrients in the corpus luteum, various conditions that could affect the production of progesterone. And that's where, excess exercise, like anorexia, obesity, like aging, stress, an underactive thyroid, hyperprolactin, like those all can interfere with the body's ability to produce progesterone, particularly in your luteal phase.
Okay, so you obviously were talking a lot about nourishing the corpus luteum and that being a very important part of the process, particularly if we're looking to maintain a pregnancy. So what would be your kind of core things to do in order to do that?
Yeah, great question. I would say from a nutrient perspective, making sure that you have adequate vitamin C, and the best way to do that through food would be having adequate antioxidants in your diet, lots of colorful fruits and veggies. Those are going to be your best sources of vitamin C. And then zinc is a very, very important nutrient for the corpus luteum. So where you can get zinc from, pumpkin seeds are a pretty high source of zinc. If you are taking any multivitamin, it will have zinc in it as well. Sometimes zinc is the one nutrient that I don't often rely on getting it strictly from food, because you might need a higher dose than you could achieve from food on a daily basis. And then the third point is around stress. And, we talked about that a lot earlier in this episode, how important it is to help, to be on top of your stress levels and your stress coping and your self-care and all that stuff. And I will say, self-care doesn't have to be, taking a bath or going to get your nails done. Like, it doesn't have to be, it could literally be something so simple as like taking your dog for a walk, or even just that awareness and that mindfulness of, okay, I am choosing for 2 minutes to lie vertically and not think about anything and just give my body that rest, like let my brain know this is a rest state. And so you're not in that fight or flight response all the time. So yeah, that's what I want to say about stress, because it can be really easy to say like, don't have stress, but who can, that's not realistic. Nobody can do that.
Well, it's funny you say this, and particularly about self-care, and particularly the point that it doesn't have to be, I'm going to try and meditate for an hour in a dark room, yes, which is not always as possible. Funnily enough, the episode we've just done previously was with an author and psychologist around, she has three books on self-care. And in fact, funnily enough, that was the point that she made, is that self-care is a very individual thing, and it doesn't have to be, you know, you spending 2 hours doing it. It can be 5 minutes of whatever it is that's nourishing to you.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, female hormones, and, you know, especially related to miscarriage and things like PCOS and thyroid. But, you know, when it comes to fertility, men are 50% of the picture. And we know that sperm counts and quality have gone down a lot over the last few decades. You know, there's obviously many, many reasons behind this. There's never one single reason. But what's your take on it from a hormonal standpoint? And what do you think are some of the things at play?
Yeah, you do run into a lot of very similar points that affect women in terms of overall level of stress, overall level of inflammation, diet, sugar. And then, you know, a big difference is also comes from like lifestyle factors that men would experience that could affect sperm production. And that is, you know, And that is sperm produced in the testicles, like they sit outside of the body. So they're going to be more susceptible to environmental causes. So, you know, men who put their cell phone in their front pocket, you know, that those rays, that radiation from your phone is going to affect, is going to damage some of the sperm. Putting like men who put their laptop on their laps, you know, the heat from the laptop as well as like the radiation from the laptop are going to affect sperm. Saunas, hot baths, wearing like tight shorts and going cycling or doing any type of exercise, anything that is causing the testicles to be overheated could damage sperm production. Luckily, sperm production does regenerate quickly. You know, every 3 months there's turnover. Well, there's turnover every day, but in terms of like the quality of sperm, like it is a 100-day process. So knowing that, it's a positive because men could change their lifestyle and within 3 months they can feel good about there being a significant change in terms of their sperm parameters.
Yeah, I think that's a really positive thing about being a man, actually, is even if you get a kind of not necessarily ideal reading on a sperm test, there's lots of changes you can make. And the good news is that it is nicely regenerative, which obviously for women is not quite as easy as that. Now, one other thing that you mentioned was, and you mentioned this in your post-pill protocol, but also, you know, you mentioned this organ as being very important for not only, you know, metabolizing hormones, but also producing them. And you mentioned the liver and, you know, specifically detoxing that, because obviously, as you say, we live in pretty toxic environment, and the body is really the best thing to actually deal with this, but sometimes we kind of overload it. So what are some of the things that you recommend to your patients when it comes to actually really supporting your liver and detoxing, and how we actually enable it to do its job the best way that it can?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when it comes to liver detoxification, your DIM, which is a compound that you get from cruciferous vegetables. So those tend to be most of your leafy green vegetables, your, you know, kale, Brussels sprouts, beets, even though they're not leafy green, but those all help in allowing for phase two detoxification of the liver. So that's definitely a place I start, you know, liver loving smoothies, liver loving foods, like, you know, starting your day with a smoothie that does have like a good handful of your greens, such as kale, even arugula. If you wanted to put dandelion in there, you could, But the one caveat is spinach. It's not in this same category, so you won't get the same benefits. But if you're thrown in like an all over mixed green, I mean, that's going to benefit you. So starting your day that way and is really important. When it comes to the liver, another thing that I like to recommend is castor oil packs. And that is castor oil is an oil, a thick oil that you can buy at most health food stores. And you can just put it over your liver. And what it's doing is it's helping with the cellular turnover. And because that oil seeps in and it creates movement of those cells. And then if you wanted to have a stronger effect, you could even add some heat to that. So that's that's something that women can do on a regular basis. Just a note that if you put it like on your abdomen or your lower abdomen, it can increase the flow of menstruation. So when you're menstruating, like just be mindful of that. But yeah, that's a really good one for liver support and liver detoxification. Again, like making sure that you're drinking enough water, and the bowels play a role here too, because you want any excessive hormones to be excreted through the bowels, not recycled back into the body. So making sure that you have regular bowel movements will help with that, because also you will get some bile that will come from the liver and some liver enzymes that help in the process of excreting those additional estrogens that you don't want to be recycling back.
So it's interesting that you talked about the castor oil pack. Funnily enough, someone who sits on our board who has suffered with endometriosis swears by that, and she now has three boys. So that's really interesting that you mentioned that. And you talk about cellular turnover. What exactly does that mean, and how is it? Is that just a regeneration thing? You know, how does that actually affect the liver, and how does it affect it, helping to metabolize our hormones better and produce, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. So this would be just helping like any cells that are, you know, not metabolically active and allowing them to kind of degenerate and be reabsorbed from the body and make new ones. So that's what I mean when I say like cellular turnover. Perhaps it's like more of a complicated question. But yeah, we won't get into that.
So, I suppose the liver is, you know, the organ that regenerates. So that actually makes a lot of sense when you say that. Now, can you tell us, because obviously this is what you do for your job, having awareness and going through your own journey with hormones and your own kind of recovery from, you know, Hashimoto's and autoimmunity. Can you tell us what like a typical day in the life looks like for you, and maybe how it's different to, you know, what it used to be before you got your diagnosis?
I have to think about that one. I would say that being really mindful about my food choices, that is something that has greatly changed over the years. And, you know, being okay to step forward and say and explain to people what it is that's going on for me, because I have an Italian background, and carbs, bread, pasta, that was a big part of what I grew up eating. And then I married my husband, and he was like, "You're the only Italian I know that doesn't eat pasta every day." And I'm like, "It's not good for me, right? It's not something that I can eat anymore." And my family, you know, a lot of them just didn't understand, but I stand up in it and I say, "This food's not good for me." And I have noticed a huge change in my health over the years, and I want to keep that up. And I think like part of the energetic piece of thyroid condition is being able to speak your truth. And that has been another part that's changed in my life, is being able to speak up for what I need and what is helpful for me, even in terms of relationships in my life. So that's changed, and I've really noticed significant improvements there. And I have to be better at listening to my body. So when you have a autoimmune condition, you aren't able to push yourself at all. I noticed I'm not able to push myself as I was able to in my early 20s. I have to rest when my body says rest. And I have to, you know, especially when it comes to exercise, I love exercise and I had to give it up for a while. And now I'm at a place where I'm able to incorporate it in a way that makes that still honors my body and that is good for me. And so that's something that's changed. In terms of self-care, that's always been something that is constantly evolving. You had mentioned earlier about, you know, self-care doesn't have to be meditating in a dark room. I will say when I struggled for so many years on meditating, I was like, I can't do it. I can't shut my brain off. Like this just is not happening for me. And then once I lifted that pressure to meditate and make it simple, make it about being outside, make it about just doing something, whatever fills my cup, whatever makes me happy, petting my dog, for example. So then now I'm at a place where I feel like I can go into a meditative state. I can experience the joys of meditation. But for people listening, like just understand when you start this journey, like that's not what self-care means. And if you want to meditate, it will happen, but it takes a while to calm the mind, especially if you're not used to that.
Wow, that's exactly my experience as well. I found it so, so difficult. And I was always thinking, oh my goodness, I'm doing it wrong. And it just became like a stressor, if anything else. And,
yes.
You know, it's my journey was exactly the same as yours. And I think that that's the biggest thing is we put so much pressure on ourselves to do things in a certain way. And actually, we should just be really tuning in and listening to what makes us feel good and what doesn't. You also mm-hmm. mentioned, you know, the greater awareness you have now about the kind of toxins that are out there. So, you know, your beauty cabinet, for example, are there any other things that you do in terms of consciousness about, you know, how to reduce your exposure to some of the kind of toxins out there?
Mm-hmm. When I first started on this path, you know, I got rid of so many beauty products and I keep things simple now. I think we can fall into this trap of feeling like we need to buy all these like very specific products, but we don't need them. And one of the big area there is cleaning products. That's the part we didn't talk about, but there's so many toxins in cleaning products, but a lot of it is like you can make your own cleaning products and it's very simple. You know, vinegar, for example, is something that can be used in a lot of like households that you can make your own with vinegar, essential oils, and then you have a great cleaner. So keeping my lifestyle very simple and minimal and not, you know, not falling into like feeling like I need to get specific products that I know aren't good for me. We didn't talk about water, but like water is a big thing, you know, making sure that you're drinking filtered water and toothpaste. Like there's so many things that in your everyday that you don't think about could be affecting your hormones.
So just coming back to what you were saying about cleaning products and keeping your lifestyle very back to basics with, you know, making your shopping bags, you know, reusable and drinking out of steel or glass containers. Is it all that kind of stuff that you're now incorporating into your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I've kind of become like really particular about plastic and making sure that like I even stainless steel, like I didn't like the taste and the metallic part of it. I'm like, well, that can't be good for my body either. So now I exclusively would say that I use a lot of glass in things. I even bought these glass straws, which I absolutely love. Reusable shopping bags for sure. I mean, we're pretty lucky that when you go anywhere, most places are going to give you, aside from the grocery store, are going to give you a reusable bag that you could use. And I get so disappointed with myself when I forget them. So I try to make a conscious effort to keep them in the trunk of my car. So every time I go to the grocery store, I could use them. But yeah, it's so many things. And I will say for listeners, like it can be very overwhelming to make all these changes. And it's not going to happen overnight, but one thing at a time, you know, you'll look back and you won't have any regrets. You'll feel good about the decisions you're making and you'll notice changes to your health that will make you continue to do that. And especially, yeah. I will say as parents, you know, you're setting an example, right, for your kids. And so when they see you making those mindful decisions around, you know, not using plastic or using like reusable bags. And they're asking about it. You know, it's you're a role model for them as well, which ultimately is going to create change in generations to come. I hope anyways.
I think that's absolutely right. I think your point is spot on that some of this can feel really, really overwhelming, but actually just doing bite-sized little things, it all adds up in the end. So so yeah, you're absolutely right on that. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much of your insight with us. As so much food for thought here. And what we'll do is we'll put links up to your site as well so people can dig into some of the topics in a little bit more detail and obviously look at your post-pill guide and things like that. And we'll also put the link up to your Instagram as well, so people can keep up to date with what's going on. So Antoinette, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for interviewing me. This was great.
Okay.